everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This hour we have a really interesting conversation for you. Yesterday was the anniversary of Loving, the case that fought for the rights for people to marry across racial lines. Came out of Virginia, but to marry across racial lines was illegal in Maryland as well. The case was decided in 1967. And we have our own kind of Loving case here in Maryland that we're celebrating today, the day after the Loving case. And we're taping it on the day that actually the anniversary of that decision in the Supreme Court. We're here with Ben Jealous. No, Ben Jealous is not that old. But he,
but I wouldn't be here.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't be here otherwise. You didn't have this story. Ben, of course, the former president of the NAACP, is now running for governor of the state of Maryland in the Democratic Party primary, is here with his parents, Ann and Fred Jealous. They are the couple we're talking about, who married, had to marry across state lines, and we'll tell that story in just a moment. So Ann and Fred Jealous, Ben Jealous, welcome. Good to have you both here. All three of you here.
It's good to be here.
Thank you.
So let's go back, obviously, to that moment. What year did you two meet, and how did you two meet?
1966, January 1966, and we married in August of 1966.
Still illegal in Maryland?
Yes.
So how did you meet, though? I mean,
we were in graduate school together, and the graduate school had a segment that necessitated us teaching in an inner city school for one semester. And Fred came from Maine to teach at Harlem Park Junior High School in Baltimore the first semester, eighth grade history.
We
had just come back from overseas. I had been in Philippines for 2 years. He was in Turkey for 2 years.
Wow.
We came, that's true. And I was the first person to go to Harlem Park. I taught the first semester, eighth grade history, and then he came in and took my classes over when I went to do another segment of the graduate program in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
It was Antioch's first graduate program.
Okay. It was called Antioch Putney because a third of the time you were in Putney, Vermont.
That's where they had the School of Education for Antioch in Putney.
A third of the time on the Yellow Springs campus, and then a third of the time in an inner city school somewhere. And we just picked the same school.
So, of course, back then, but inner city meant something very different because we lived in a legally segregated world where there were
He was the only Caucasian teacher in the school. Is that right?
Seems right, at least if I remember the class, you know, the teacher's rooms. I was the only white person in the teacher's rooms. It was a big school, though. There were 2,000 students then.
Right.
About 99.9% African-American students.
And what was the 0.1%?
A little sugar cube in the middle of the chocolate, right?
So I'm curious, before we jump into the heart of your hearts and how this all happened, I'm curious what it was like for you from Maine via Putney, Yellow Springs, coming to Baltimore to teach in an all-black school in a city that was still fundamentally as segregated as it was during legal segregation, which is only just a year old.
Well, I was coming from living overseas in the Middle East for 2 years. So that cross-cultural experience was, you know, for a white boy from New England, was an incredible education. So I'd been opened up and exposed to my own arrogance and ignorance and all the kinds of things you get when you grow up in a white community in New England. So I was ready for another adventure in a way I don't think I would have been if I had just was coming from, like, straight from college. At the time, I was excited about it. I'd been involved in civil rights activities in university, and so I was kind of looking forward
to getting back. Or somewhere else?
Somewhere else, to Clark University in Massachusetts.
Right.
And so I was excited, really.
We were in our 20s,
and you know, I wanted the full immersion. I wanted to live in the neighborhood and So Anne's mom found me a place to live, a room in the home of a retired teacher on Lafayette Street, just two blocks from the school.
Who was the teacher?
Mrs. Maccabee. She's an old music teacher. At the time, she was retired and quite elderly, but very generous for me, gave me a nice room and kitchen, and I was just two blocks from the school, so that was terrific in terms of seeing the kids after school and being in the neighborhood and getting involved in a little bit. Some of the mothers really liked me because I knew where their children were when they didn't know.
and you grew up here though, right?
I grew up here.
This is your city.
Yes, that's right. So I came back here after being in the Peace Corps so that I would be with my family. I hadn't seen them for 2 years. We didn't have cell phones in those days or computers, right?
Where were you in the Peace Corps?
I was in the Philippines. So I came back, and I wanted to go to Antioch. I had gone there as an undergraduate, but I graduated from American University, and I wanted to return to Antioch. And when I heard that they had a graduate program, I really didn't. I said, I'm going to go into that graduate program. I don't care what it's in, right? I just really wanted to return there. So that's that. How that happened. But then Fred came in January, and when I really reflect seriously on what happened between us, I think it was almost as though we recognized each other. It's kind of a dramatic thing. I mean, he proposed three times before he got me to say yes, but
three times in one week,
right?
Ben.
Because it all went really rapidly, and I really felt as though I'm supposed to be with this person. In addition to feeling love for him, I also got a message like, "This is your life. This is this person." And so it really doesn't matter. I mean, after I'd gone through no because it's against the law, no, you know, no because that's going to be too hard, it was as though I got a message that you're not to let a law dictate your life and in your life's journey, and this is the journey. And so once I did that and got one person, my family, to know a way ahead of everybody else, that this was going to happen, and to say that she would love him if I loved him, then I said yes. And it's strange, but it really felt like what's supposed to be, and it obviously has been. I mean, you know, 51 years in August.
Y'all are still together, so there you are.
Yeah, right. 51 years in August, right. and really good things have come from this union. I mean, really good things, in addition to Benjamin. And a beautiful daughter. And
Other kids, right?
We have a beautiful daughter who's older than Ben, and three grandchildren, and we have created a community like the one we always wanted to live in. Without sitting down and planning it, we're a great team.
What do you mean you built a community? What does that mean?
Well, we've both been really involved for, let's say, Fred brought the National Coalition Building Institute to our town, to our county. And we've both been volunteers with that and diversity trainers with that for over 20 years. Fred has co-started a group called Whites for Racial Equity about a year ago, and they have a fabulous, resourceful website. I wrote, co-edited and co-authored an anthology with a white woman friend and colleague, with 52 white people writing about the grief they feel living in a society with a racist ideology. We won the ACLU's award together, the only couple that's ever been awarded at the same moment that award. And we've had other honors. Fred started a major organization for men that's transformed the ways that they are with their families and their wives and their husbands.
It was just your mom's book,
really good,
called Combined Destinies. White Sharing Grief About Racism, is 52 white people's stories about how racism against blacks has hurt their own lives. A range of stories. My dad's stories in there, his experience of being disowned and disinherited for marrying my mom. But also, you know, the story of a man who would become a SNCC activist, but as a boy, his father was a Klansman.
Who's that?
Bob Zelda.
I know Bob.
You know Bob.
I know Bob. Bob Zelda. Bob, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so Bob tells the story, right, of his father killing a black man in front of him when he was a child, and then his father losing his mind because he was also a Methodist preacher.
Right.
And ultimately reconciling his theology and his beliefs and his place in the world by leading his family into the civil rights movement and really setting the foundation for what's been Bob's life.
Right, he's an amazing guy, raised in Alabama.
And back and that in, book was very proud to say Mom won a National Independent Book Award for Best Anthology for that book.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that all of these things, and then Fred's breakthrough with men's community is just was stunning, and its consequences over 1,800 men. It's still going on. He's retired, but there must be at least 1,800 men have gone through this program, and we come from a small community. So it's a lot of impact when you're in a little pond.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, and it just feels like it's been absolutely right. In addition to all, I mean, and the love has fueled it, you know, all of that. Our love is really, yeah.
So, go ahead. No, please, what were you going to say?
No, I'm basically nodding my head, agreeing, you know, with everything that she said. And, you know, she mentioned this men's school for men.
Yeah.
And it was a logical outcome of both the civil rights movement and the men's movement, I mean, and the women's movement, because it was clear that if evolution's going to continue, then men have to be willing to change the role. They can't stay stuck in the old patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
But Ted, it was also an outgrowth of your work working with men for years who were beating their wives, beating
their
children.
Men's Alternatives to Violence. He created that organization too.
Yeah.
Where was all this taking place?
In California, Monterey County.
Yeah, my parents would send me back to West Baltimore every summer. But they ultimately, they chose a place where they felt like their marriage and their family would be, you know, sort of like most normal, if you will.
No, I understand that. I mean, because so they're taking back to that moment. You, interracial marriages were not very common back in the 60s, 50s and 60s
right.
at all.
2%.
Right?
Yeah, that was low.
I'm sorry.
2%. I just happened to see the statistics. I think it was 2% in 1967, two or three.
And you were living, as we all were, in the state of Maryland, which didn't allow interracial marriages. So what's the story of your getting married? I mean, so you two met at Harlem Park, fell in love. You finally said yes.
We didn't meet at Harlem Park. We were never there at the same moment. We met in my house because the snowstorm kept the airplanes from flying to Ohio, and I was stranded. And because my mother was finding a place for Fred to live.
Okay.
You see, so he came to my house, and that's where my parents' house, and that's essentially.
And where was your parents' house? Where did you grow up in town?
I grew up on, we've gone several places, but from 7 to 14, I was on Pulaski Street. But at the time that I met Fred, I think we had moved to that house on Longwood Street when I was 14. So that was there until essentially they sold that house eventually after we got married and moved to Ashburton area.
Yeah, and it was one of those really big snowstorms that shuts Baltimore down for days. I mean, their street wasn't even plowed. I had to
walk up most of it.
1966.
1966. Right. Well, Baltimore snowed every year, but Baltimore always right. acted like it never snows.
Right. Every year something it was usually a hit every year.
That's
one
right.
major hit at least.
That's right.
Right?
But
right.
There was no preparation for it.
Right.
You know, it was like a surprise.
No. I remember those snowstorms well.
It still can be that way.
It can still be that way. We'll talk about that next week together.
Activists come together to plead with the city. Please prepare this time.
So you got married in D.C. then. Now, to talk about that beginning of your marriage, you had to get married in D.C. and then how did the world work out?
Well, we were still in graduate school, so we came here to get married. We spent the summer in Putney, Vermont, and then we came here to get married in D.C. So everybody trooped over to Washington for the wedding and a brief reception, then they all trooped back to Ann's parents' house for another reception. And then we left on our honeymoon. And
where'd you go?
Went to Europe. I had a little bit of money left over from my grandmother, and so we did a great thing by just going off for 6 weeks by ourselves in Europe.
Right.
We had letters that we wrote back and forth like every week, but for most of that period between January and the wedding day, he was one place, I was another place. And then we were together in Vermont for the summer, and we got married. So then we had 6 weeks in Europe together. And then we moved from there to Yellow Springs, Ohio. Fred had some work left to do on his graduate program, and it still was illegal in Maryland.
Right.
For us to live together. Right. We couldn't cohabit here, you see.
But did you? Did you live together here in Maryland?
Never.
You did not. I mean, and the families. I mean, I can remember when Saeed and I got married in 1968 in Baltimore. It was just then just legal, and well, she was Debbie then, but became Saeed. You're talking about being disowned. I'm curious about the story of how your families reacted. I remember. Both fathers, my father, neither one of them showed up for the wedding. My father nor her father. Pop disowned me at first. We became good friends, and we resolved that later. And Debbie's father, Willie Stone, lovely man, both World War II veterans, didn't come, but then we became close as well. But there was a real difficult thing because he wasn't, I mean, neither world really wanted to see people crossing and getting married, right?
My father picked the photograph of my father walking me down the aisle. Looks as though he's taking me to the gallows. I'm not
right.
kidding.
Right,
his
right,
faith,
right.
He grew up in Virginia in the middle of virulent racism.
Right.
And his head was down. He was stoic. But it looked like, you know, this is death here.
At the same time, I mean, let's be clear. Mom, I think your suggestion is that that's him sort of dealing with the social significance.
Yes,
I mean, he loved
absolutely.
Dad. And
it had nothing to do with Fred as a person.
Right.
But it did have to do with the cross-racial and the expectation of how we were going to be treated and all the pain and agony that was probably going to come down the road. And, you know, it was all of that because he
right.
loved me dearly. And he also walked me down the aisle. I mean, even with all of that feeling, he showed up. You know, I felt supported by him. But
and I think there
really
were two.
Telling.
You know, he liked me. We had Sunday dinner together for a whole semester while I was teaching,
and he really liked me.
But when it came to marrying his only child and his daughter,
at that, right?
Then he had some other stuff to process and go through, and you know, he was always very kind to me and. Wonderful, but it was a challenge for him to let his only daughter marry a white guy, and then he's going off with her to God knows where. That was a big deal for him, and he didn't know me enough to know how stable I'd be and would I do the right thing for her.
He also was an introvert, so he wasn't going to talk about that with anybody.
It took a while for him to really kind of let go of all of his worries.
Yeah.
And see, oh, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, she's going to be okay.
And
it's going to be okay.
And eventually he called him son. He just really, you know, he let go. It took some years to really be there, which is all very understandable given the circumstances. And we were in the middle, if you remember, in the 66 was a hotbed of racial tension.
Right.
Fred and I came off planes from other countries and walked right into a city that was wild.
I mean, that was just the beginning of Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture.
Right, that's right. Right.
Black power movement, began, and the civil rights movement. The SNCC was dividing by on race too, and that was happening. All that was moving at that
time.
Yeah, right.
While
I was teaching in Harlem Park, I remember Stokely Carmichael coming on, and the kids wanting to talk about when the phrase Black Power comes out, then the dark skinned kids in the school wanted to talk about why, you know.
Yeah, because up until that point, if people maybe don't remember unless you're a certain age, that even using the word black back in the 60s, it was like, people have to go, you call me what?
That's
me
right. That's right. It was
and
an offense.
It was like a whole new consciousness shift and change.
That's right.
Affected
that's
the kids deeply and everybody else as well.
Yeah.
So what about your family?
The adult men in my family, that being my uncle and my grandfather, and the only two adult men that
parents went around.
My father was deceased. My mother was still around.
Okay.
But the adult men disowned me.
The adult men disowned you?
Yes. My grandfather, you know, don't come through the door again of my house and you're disinherited. And my uncle, my father's brother said, you know, how could you give a black baby the family name? I mean, he was just horrified.
Right, which, by the way, Dad was already thinking about taking Mom's name just because the name Jealous is, you know, can be kind of awkward.
You know, if
so to protect me from that.
It's like, how can you give me this name? Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I felt it. And your name is what? Are you an interracial couple? Really? Jealous?
Yeah, right. Is he, are
is
you?
He, are
you?
Let's just recognize that the ACLU is very smart in choosing Loving versus Virginia, because Jealous versus
Virginia. Hold on, Dave. Right. I love it.
Yeah. So it was my friends, you know, the white guys I'd been to high school with up in Maine, were fine once they got used to the idea and, you know, had parties for us. My mother was fine. The women seemed to be fine. And my peers, fine and intrigued, you know. And I was, I was always a little bit of an oddball. I was raised a Unitarian with all these Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics and Lutherans, and so, you know, I'm the guy that says, you know, why are we telling Polish jokes while we're playing poker? Why are we doing? You know, I'm the guy who would raise that kind of thing. So I already had a little bit of a reputation for doing surprising things, they were fine. And I think very positive. Yeah. And my mother, you know, my mother had one of her finest moments as a parent when she met Anne's parents. Uh-huh. I mean, she jumped right in with them. She said, you know, if I were you, I'd be concerned about this white guy just, you know, who's been involved maybe he's getting carried away. You know, he's got involved in civil rights. He's teaching in an African-American school, and maybe he's just gotten carried away.
momentary lapse.
Yeah,
After 51 years.
And my mother was great. I mean, she just took it right on with them, which was, it was a reasonable thing for them to think. And she went right after it and just said, no, I want you to know he's got a whole history of, you know, involvement with African-American folks, and this is not his first, you know, friendship or relationship, you know, in the African American community. And
one of his groomsmen, one of Dad's groomsmen, was Dave Chappelle's dad.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, actually,
it was one of his best friends.
Wedding. Yeah, he sang at our wedding.
Wow.
Yeah, he was he was Fred's friend before Fred and I met, and Fred and I went over to Washington on one of our very first dates for him to introduce me to Bill Chappelle, who then became a really, really close friend to both of us.
Yeah. So, and the net result for that, for me, is that I'm still known as Dave Chappelle's Puerto Rican bodyguard. Because when you're a light-skinned black guy in New York City.
You're passing.
They just assume, and you can't say that you're not Puerto Rican because then people get upset.
Right.
So you're just like, all right, whatever.
Yeah. So, Chris, I mean, where were you married in D.C.? What church are you married?
St. Mary's Episcopal Church.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because that time, it was very rare for the races to cross at all.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It's still
That's
too rare today.
Jim Crow was
really
alive
rare
and well
at that moment, right?
That's
with black or white worlds, I mean, unless there was some conscious thing going on, like there was a...
No, there really was apartheid.
Right.
I mean, really, name it for what it was.
Right.
It was just absolutely, especially in cities where there was enough space to have black theaters and white theaters and a black library and, you know,
right.
all of that.
And two Easter parades. One went down Pennsylvania Avenue, one went down Charles Street.
That's right. That's right.
When I was a kid.
And
yeah.
hospitals were separated.
Right.
And, I mean, everything was separated.
And that's why yesterday was such a big deal, because in the context of that life, a church was an extension of home. And Mom had grown up at St. James.
St. James Episcopal.
Yeah,
she had
gone to Sunday school. Her parents had taught Sunday school, and
she
had always
the choir. And you know, excuse me, Benjamin. The other piece of that is that we did not have any place to go to have parties, dances, except
right.
at school and church. And so it was the center of our social life, as well as the center of our religious life.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
And so Mom had always envisioned that she would get married there. And that's why it was so important yesterday to have this vow renewal at St. James, because it meant she got to walk down the aisle at St. James before this kind of turned around the sun, it's all over. You know?
And even before you two met, you did your own pioneering work as a kid. You,
yes.
Talk about the lawsuit, and you were the first.
Yeah, I was in the first group
to go to
Western High School. Yeah, and we were part of the NAACP. I went in 55.
55.
And that was the first year that Maryland was forced to obey the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision. You know, so the law passed in 54. Maryland resisted for a year. The principal of Western said, over my dead body, will these black girls come into my school? But they were legally forced, to allow us to come in.
How many were you?
There were 10 of us. And we were actually called into the, as I remember it, we were called into the counselor's office at our junior high school.
And where was it? Where'd you go?
Which was Booker T. Washington.
Booker T. Right.
And we were told that we had been handpicked for this first entry into Western, and that that we're handpicked because we had good grades, we were involved in extracurricular activities, and we were in complete homes, which they meant at that time by two parents living there, and the parents would be supportive of this because we were going to need their support, and that whatever followed was going to be partly based on how we were there. So for somebody 14 years old, 13 and a half, whatever, I guess I was 13 then,
right.
That was a huge responsibility. I was a pretty responsible kid. So we all were, which is why we were chosen. So the next year, we went to Western, and the moms were picketing outside to get us out, and the girls inside didn't want us there, and the principal had already said over my dead body, and the counselors ultimately did not, at the end of this saga, and that I was a newspaper editor at Booker T, and so they asked me to be on the news staff at Western, and I was chosen, as I had gone before and won contests when the contests were segregated, but now be going, you know, representing the school and at a contest that was not separate, that was essentially white mostly, and the principal said, we will not enter. Mm. And they didn't enter because they didn't want me to represent them. So it was pretty intense. And then at the end of the when it was time to send off applications to colleges, the counselors had to send our transcripts, and the counselors said they would not send our transcripts to anywhere other than what are now called historically black colleges. And one of I think that what that did to me that I regret was that because I was so determined to not let these people run my life that I didn't even consider going to any historically black college because they said that's all I'd get into.
Right.
And you see, if without that, I probably would have, and I don't know where I would have gone, but my mother who looks white, she's has to tell everybody all the time that she's African-American, which she's done forever, but she took the counselor out to lunch and talked to her. You're a mother, I'm a mother, we both have children, and my mother's a social worker and a very persuasive, and she essentially got this woman to see their commonality and then to agree to send my transcripts to the schools that I'd chosen to go to.
So I mean, I'm just imagining the difficulty for these 10 young girls.
Yeah, it was something. She said we wouldn't be accepted anywhere else, and so therefore they weren't going to bother sending these transcripts. That
but
was
I mean,
her
for
statement.
For the 10 of you at that school.
Yeah.
I mean, how just the kind of.
Some were in a came in to the 10th grade.
Right.
And some of us went into the 9th grade.
Were you a 9th or 10th grader?
I was a 9th grader.
Wow.
And they set us on as I remember it, they set us on the front row, the front seat of each row, so they could keep our eyes on us because my mother had a friend somewhere at the school, a teacher who knew my mother in some way, and she would give my mother information about what these other people were doing. She was like a spy. And so they have black stars by our names in their books. And they set us in the front seat so they could watch us because they were sure we would cheat. And they cut our grades down. Some of them cut our grades down by a whole letter point because it couldn't be possible for you to get an A. So you must have cheated, so we'll give you a B. Or you to get a B, we'll give you a C or whatever. So it was a very, very huge resistance in Maryland against desegregating the schools.
Pardon me one second.
Yeah.
A little dry throat. It's water. Sorry.
Yeah, and that's a lot of information. I don't know if
that.
But that, you know, it was a rough time. It was indeed a rough time.
I can imagine it. I mean, I remember the time in Baltimore. So I can remember when that happened. How many of the, before we come back to you all again, how many of the women are still with us?
Well, I went to a 50. Actually, a book that Benjamin mentioned came because of several things. One was because Fred has had such pain over racism, and I watched that and lived with his pain as well as with my own. And also, I had a couple of experiences as a therapist, that I was a marriage and family therapist for almost 30 years. But the thing that pushed that book, really, which had sort of been an idea in the back of my mind, was going to the 50th reunion of the high school and meeting a classmate, a white classmate, who came over to me at this reunion, which was essentially a luncheon, and said, "You changed my life, what you said. Made me change my life." And I said, "What did I say?" I didn't remember her. And she said, "We were standing together." I guess she had just gotten there. And I think maybe we were, by then, 10th or 11th graders. Anyway, she came in for the last couple of years of high school from the county somewhere. And we were all standing together. And she said, "I'd never been in school with the black girls before, or African Americans, or Negroes, whatever word she used. Never been there before."
Probably the Platon was Negro back in the day.
Yeah, right. Well, back in the day, it was Negro, right. You know, but that day it was African Americans. So she probably said African American girls. Never been in a school, in a situation with them at all. And there were several of us all together, just me, and I was the only African American in that talking group. And she said, "And I made a racist comment," she said, "about herself. And then I realized you were there. And I looked at you and apologized, and you said, 'That's okay, I'm used to it.'" And she said, "When you said, 'I'm used to it,' I got that I was part, I don't remember her exact language, but her communication was, she got that she was part of a system she didn't want to be part of. So she raised, so I became a minister. I raised my children with cross-racial friendships. And she went on to tell me the impact. And she traced back to that moment when she was a teenager. So that pushed me into saying, these stories, people's changes, the resistance to racism, but also their stories of how they feel guilt or they feel shame, they feel whatever they're feeling, need to be part of this addressing the issue of racism. It's got a lot of puzzle pieces, and this is one of them. How does it affect white people? How does it affect white kids? And people just poured in the stories, and so we did this anthology.
So I'm wondering, do you want to jump in before I ask another question? We're sitting here talking, I hope you're enjoying this conversation, I know you are. We're sitting here with Ann and Fred Jealous, who are the parents of Ben Jealous. Ann and Fred got married here in Maryland, got married when it was illegal for people to be married as an interracial couple. They had to be married in D.C. They're here with their son Ben Jealous, taking a break, come right back. We're here with Ann and Fred Jealous, the parents of Ben Jealous, talking about on this anniversary of loving 50 years. 50 years has been amazing, 50 years. And they've been married 51 years, which means they broke the law.
We did.
In 1966 when they married, Ann is from Baltimore, Fred's from New England. They met here in Baltimore, married in D.C., and one of their progeny is in the studio with us, Ben Jealous, who's running for governor of the state of Maryland, which we'll talk about another day.
Yes.
But good to have you all here. So I'm curious, as you look at this world over the last 51 years, and that the consciousness in America about race and racism has changed. Most people did not talk about racism in the 1950s or 60s. They talked about prejudice. And things like that, and fighting the end of legal segregation. But the idea about racism, or how deeply racism is embedded in the consciousness of this country, that plays out differently depending on who you are, what community you grew up in, and wherever else. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about that spectrum, from that moment when you all were kind of involved, as many of us were, in ending legal segregation, but also crossing these lines that weren't being crossed. What do you think about this arc of these last 51 years?
Well, one of the best pieces of good news is the increase in the number of so-called interracial couples that have gotten married. I think 17% of the marriages now are considered cross-racial, cross-cultural, however you want to define that.
One out of every six new marriages.
So one out of every six.
Right.
Yeah.
New ones.
Right.
Yeah, and that 25% of the families in the country have somebody in their family who's in such a relationship. And that kind of intimacy educates people like nothing else does. So I think that's a, excuse me, that's a real positive. I think on the dark side of it all, I think the reaction to the civil rights movement, the real reactive part of it that led to dog whistle politics in general and mass incarceration and things like that. It was so cleverly done and so destructive, and I think we're seeing a lot of, we're now getting a real education about all of it, because the public has been given permission by Donald Trump to be disrespectful and violent. which is just, it's tragic. I also, I mean, another thing that I've seen changed, you know, I got the best and the brightest are white education when I was in public school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you want to believe it's true. You want to believe you're one of the good guys. And the stuff that they didn't tell us, the truths that they didn't tell us about, you know, whether it's the founding of the country or the history of the country or Jim Crow or whatever, what they didn't tell us was profound. You mean it kept white people in a state of ignorance that's had, you know, been part of the problem, is people just don't know the truth. And most, if most people just are high school graduates and they had a public education, then they're much more subject to all the propaganda. Another positive that I'm seeing is this information has finally gotten out. I mean, so much good information has come out just in the last 10 years. You know, whether it's the stuff on dog whistle politics or stuff. Right. But I think people are getting educated, if they're willing to listen, in a way that's really helpful. I mean, those are a few of the things that come to mind.
The
right
thing
away.
That concerns yeah. me is the de facto segregation that exists. I see it in California. I see it in Maryland. I may see it everywhere. People living, you know, and it's a lot of that was planned and so forth. But regardless of the reason for it, it still exists a great extent. And we really need to be together in order to learn about each other, in order to care about each other, in order to recognize our common humanity, and also to be able to see that this system that we live with is harmful to every single person, and it is harmful, I believe, to everybody in this country, regardless of whether you know about it, know that it is or not. Regardless of whether or not mm-hmm. you recognize the harm it's creating for you, it's creating harm. And when we break down the barriers or we take courageous steps into a community that of people that don't look like us, we get all kinds of benefits, including a claiming of one's own humanity and connections that help us think well. About this world and about our country. So I don't know how long it's going to take to. I see things going backwards in some ways. In some parts of the country, I see public schools becoming more and more full yeah. of kids who belong to minority groups and. Neighborhoods still, because of the economic disparity, being segregated racially. So that's all very upsetting. And at the same time, I think Fred's point is really a good one. More and more families are having more and more members that don't look exactly like them in terms of color.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Mark, you know, the... I think the... fight for LGBTQ equality has given sort of new meaning to this case.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a long time we saw Loving versus Virginia as the capstone of a series of racial civil rights victories in housing, employment, and you know, ultimately marriage. In this current major struggle for basic rights protections. It's notable that marriage equality for that community comes before we've settled the score in bathrooms, before we've passed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And so I think it, Loving versus Virginia, half century in the rearview mirror, is actually, less of a capstone than a cornerstone, right? A part of the foundation for the continuing struggle for civil and human rights in this country.
It's interesting because you mentioned Loving, because Mildred Loving came out very strongly for the rights of gays and lesbians to marry in America.
Yeah. That's not surprising.
Yeah, she made a very strong statement.
Yeah, that is not surprising because once you see humans as humans, you know, and we all give us the right to love whomever we want to love, and if we need our love to be legalized, then we ought to be able to do that, you know, and some people don't, but those who do need to have the right to do that, and I'm not surprised at all that she is supportive.
Were you aware of the Loving case when you were seeing each other before you were married?
Oh, yes.
And when you were married?
And there was a case in the courts or somewhere in legal system in Maryland.
There was. That was David Smith's case. He finally got married in 67. I forget his wife's name.
Right. But, she's Filipina, I think.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember that. And of course, because I had just come back from the Philippines, that stuck in my mind that this is this woman that
right.
was...
Because David Smith was part of the civil rights movement here in Maryland.
Right, I remember. But
and were you all part of the civil rights movement back in that era as well?
Yeah,
yes.
We did. And I think certainly the, you mean prior to that time? Yeah.
Late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah. Fred, go on to talk. Why don't you?
Yeah, I was going to school in Massachusetts at Clark University. And we raised funds to support voting rights, and then eventually ended up creating, you know, students were being kicked out of traditionally black universities in the South, like
right.
Southern University. So we saw that, you know, got to raise funds for them to continue their education, and then I was doing stuff in Worcester related to that, going around getting the community to commit to support the university and the university to support it and that kind of thing. And then when I came back and I was, excuse me, back from Turkey and I was in Baltimore, start teaching American history to kids in Harlem Park Junior High School. Well, it seemed like, you know, you're their teacher, these are your students, they're entrusted to you. You better get active again. So I signed up to work with CORE. Integrating
here in Baltimore.
Place here in Baltimore, and did the CORE weekend thing, going to the lunch counters, and getting arrested on Baltimore streets, and
right.
He was in jail with that.
Yeah,
you got arrested here in Baltimore.
Yeah,
a couple times. My mother bailed him. Did your mother bail you out? My mother raised.
Well, you know, the funny thing, I mean, to hear my grandma tell it. My grandma's very light skinned, and she actually, one of the few times in her life that she passed for white was to pretend that she was his mother to go check
on him. She didn't have to say anything. It was like she walked into the jail and they said, "Jealous, your mother is here." And she did not counter them.
Right.
And she was
angry. Saying, "Oh, actually, I'm a Negro, excuse me."
Because they had taken away his glasses and she was outraged. And so she went in with her fury and her color and she got his glasses back. You see, she took sandwiches to all the people.
She went to Altman's on the way.
Yeah, she did. 11 o'clock at night, she said. I went
Bring
to Altman's
all
and
corned
I got
beef sandwiches.
It was her favorite deli, and she bought them all sandwiches.
That's so funny.
So that was her. And then at Antioch, I remember being in picket lines for the movie theaters in Xenia, trying to get them desegregated. It was 9 miles from Yellow Springs. It was this very southern, very segregated town. And also, 5 of us, 5 students, drove to Tent City.
You talking about Resurrection City?
Tent City in Tennessee, I guess it is. After being part of a group that collected clothes and money from students at Wilberforce and Central State and Antioch to take to people who had been kicked off of out of their jobs and out of their homes because they had tried to register to vote. And so because of that, because these people worked the land and lived on a shack or a house or whatever on the land
right,
they worked.
Right, right.
When they lost their job, they lost their homes. The federal government sent tents, old army tents were no longer being used, and they formed what I believe was the first tent city. I think it was in Fayetteville, Tennessee, or whatever, remember. And we traveled by night because we were told the Klan would look for us to carry these supplies to these folks who were in tents with little kerosene cookers and lamps, and it was a horrendous situation, just horrendous. But we did that, and we didn't stop. We had one dramatic moment. That's amusing now, but it's really not amusing. That was a sort of a shack they put up so that they could have a place that wasn't a tent. And they had a jukebox, and they had a, you know, we're talking 1959, okay, 1959. Jukebox, and they were cooking, you know, ribs and chicken and whatever. So we went in, and we were a white-black group. I mean, there was an African-American male student and three white students, another girl and a couple guys, and me. And we went in, and we were friends. And we had social gatherings on campus and all of that, and we were friends. And we knew it was awful, but we didn't know quite how awful it was. And so one of the white boys asked me to dance in this jukebox, and I agreed. And the place went crazy. We were only African-Americans in there. And they went crazy. They will burn us down. They will burn us to the ground. You know, we were, 18, 19 years old and ignorant of how extreme the racism was. So, of course, we stopped dancing instantly. But that moment is there in my memory forever.
So it's really been a sojourn. It's
yes. I mean, the stories, I was just realizing how these stories could just keep going.
Because
there's also the civil rights and the Vietnam War, where they intersect, and so there's lots to talk about.
Well, this to me is a fascinating discussion. And being a core, we don't have time to get into it, but you must have known the great Walter P. Carter.
Yes.
Who actually saved my life in a civil rights demonstration. That's a story for another day.
Oh, okay.
Back in 1960. An amazing man. But this has been really just a joy to meet the two of you. I'm really glad we can get this arranged and have you come by our studios today.
Well, thank you
thank you very much.
We learn a little bit more every time we talk about it.
Yeah. That's good.
And reflect on
it. And it's healing for us.
It never stops.
Yeah. And it's healing to talk about all that stuff. It really is, because we get wounded by it all, you know.
Absolutely. That doesn't end.
Yeah.
We've been here with Ann and Fred Jellis talking about their marriage, their interracial marriage that took place while it was still illegal. They got married in D.C. This took place in 1966 when it was illegal to do them in Maryland. Their son Ben Jellis is in the studio, of course, former president of NAACP, and is running for governor of the state of Maryland. To Ann and Fred, thank you so much for coming to the studio. Ben, thank you for arranging this. Good to have you all here.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Let's open some more eyes together. Good to have you all here.